And I want to pick just three simple points, nothing very complicated, from this passage. And the first one is that Jesus chooses his friends. Now, there's a saying, isn't there, about your family and your friends? That you can choose your friends, but not your family. Well, obviously, if you're blessed and have a lovely family, that's wonderful, isn't it? You might have chosen them. But often people moan about their family, saying, oh, you know, my brother's a pain, or you know, all these sort of things that people say. But you choose your friends. Jesus said in verse 16, you did not choose me, but I chose you. If you go, you don't need to look this up, but if you were to go back into the Gospels, for example, here I've got Matthew chapter 4, verse 18 open, and it says this. While walking by the Sea of Galilee, Jesus saw two brothers, Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea. And they were fishermen. And he said, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. Immediately left their nets and followed him. And going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, in the boat with Zebedee, their father, mending their nets. And he called them. And we know the stories. And as I was thinking about this, I was thinking how remarkable this is, that the eternal God, the second person of the Trinity, steps from the glory, the eternity, the majesty, the wonder of heaven, And he steps into time. You know, it's that wonderful Christmas hymn, isn't it? My God contracted to a span, incomprehensibly made man. And he comes into this world, and his mission is to seek and save that which was lost. To save all those that the Father had given to him in eternity past, in the great plan of salvation. So he comes into this world to do that remarkable job. So, you know, the divine person comes into this world, a tiny speck of dust in a little universe that he made, to do this wonderful work of saving a generation. In fact, when we go to Revelation, we realize that the amount of people saved cannot be calculated, a number which no man can count. So even the accountant, who has a special calculator with extra digits on it, I think Andrew might have one of those, he's an accountant, they have extra digits. You cannot calculate. So there's this mission to save millions and millions of people. And he chooses these 12 men. Wow, it's astonishing. They would be the means of laying the foundations for the worldwide church, right up to the second coming. So he chooses these men. Now, we've got to be very careful here, but as I was reading it, and as you start to read about the disciples, if you didn't know better, you might question Jesus' judgment. I mean, who would you have chosen if this was your mission? Well, I was making a list of the sort of people I would choose to change the world. I would probably choose people with very sharp intellects. I want clever people, you know, that's what we want for people to run the country, isn't it? Clever people. We're not sure we always get them, but we want clever people. I want people who are strategic thinkers. They can think beyond the sort of the next week, bigger picture people. I want people who are brave, who can make decisions. I want people, people with influence. They've got connections, so important, because the movers and shakers who get stuff done, they have connections. So these are the kind of people I would choose. But then you look at who he chose. Who did he choose? He chose men who doubted him, men who let him down in his hour of need, men who denied him, men who ran away, men who sort of just were failures, flawed people. Were they great intellects? Well, Matthew might have kind of been okay with numbers, but I suspect the rest of them weren't. These were not scholars. These were rough fishermen. He chose them. Did he make a mistake? Well, of course he didn't. Of course he didn't. If you read the accounts and pull all the accounts together, the father gave those men to Jesus. And Jesus spent all night in prayer before choosing them. Remember, there weren't just 12, there were many disciples, but he chose the 12 out of the greater number after a night of prayer. So he didn't make a mistake. So this is even more wondrous and mysterious, because Jesus knew when he chose those men that Judas would sell him for 30 pieces of silver. He knew that Peter would curse and say that he didn't know him. He knew that they would squabble about who's going to be top dog in the kingdom. He knew that they'd all run away. He knew all of that. He knew what kind of men they were, and yet he chose them. I just think that is such a simple point, but astonishing. So, and what is the application? Well, clearly the application is you. He chose you. Why did he choose? Were you more clever? Were you brave? Were you strategic thinking? Did he say, well, I'll choose Mike Warren, and I'll choose Alan and Andrew, and so, because, well, they've got connections, that they're strategic thinkers, I could use them. No. Lost sinners, flawed, weak, people who let him down day after day. He chose them. And that's a comfort and a thrill, because he chose you. And I think Sukesh says this a lot from the pulpit. It's not like he chose you, and then gradually, as he sees your Christian life with its ups and downs, he then sort of says, oh, I made a mistake. I know I chose them, and I suppose I'll have to let them in heaven because their sins have been forgiven, but I kind of wish I hadn't. That is not how it is. That is not what the Bible teaches us. He chose us. He loves us. He gave his life for us. So if you're a Christian today, it is my privilege to remind you of this wonderful truth that God chose you out of all the people in your class at school. He chose you out of all the people who lived in your town, lived in your street, maybe in your family. He chose you. Why? Well, humanly speaking, we can't answer that. All we can do is come back to faith, come back to his word. He chose us because he chose us. He set his love upon us in eternity past. And then in time, he came after us and tracked us down and troubled us and made us miserable and then showed us the gospel, and it became hazy and we weren't quite sure what we were doing. And there might have been even a time when we thought that we chose him. But then we realized, as the fog of confusion kind of dispelled, we saw the wonderful truth that he chose me as his friend. Isn't that wonderful? That is thrilling. So, Jesus chooses his friends. Okay. Secondly, he transforms his friends. He transforms his friends. I started to look at the walk, the 3 years that Jesus walked with his disciples. And I was sort of thinking that, you know, I tried to visualize these men. What it was like. We have a sort of skewed version, I think, because even though we know this is not true, we're used to pictures of Jesus from American books or children's books, dressed in white, sort of a little bit taller than everybody else, a bit Hollywood, and these disciples, and this was kind of idealistic. But it wasn't like that. This was a rough, tough world. Jesus was a working class man. I was talking to Sukesh on Friday, and he did make me laugh, but he said, remember, he said, Jesus and his disciples, these were not cultured people. The Jews of the day, the Sanhedrin and the rulers, they would have looked down on him. He was from Nazareth. And Sukesh said he probably slurped his soup. And I go, I get that. In other words, he wasn't from a royal household with the manners of court. And I love that. He probably slurped his soup. That was, the pastor said that, so I'm okay repeating it. But this was a real man with real friends. And yet, he gave his heart to them. How did he get them to where he wanted them. I just want to look at this with you for a second here. I got a quote here, actually, which was just about friendship and thinking about Jesus. It said, the essential quality in the heart of friendship is not the desire to have friends, but to be a friend. I thought it was quite interesting, isn't it? So, it's not like Jesus came and said, I'm really lonely, I want some friends. He chose these men because he wanted to bless them. For sure, he did need friends. It was a lonely path, but he came to help them and to impart blessing to them. He came to give, not to... He said, I came to serve and not to be served. So, what did Jesus want to achieve when he chose these men? And how did he go about it? In other words, what was his vision for them? And how did he get them there? How did he get them there? And the answer is, he took them on a journey of 3 years. And he walked with them. He walked with them. I work for a company, and like a lot of companies, we have a vision statement. Okay, it's very popular. You know, you word craft something that sounds kind of great and stick it on the wall, and everybody sort of, that's the vision. In other words, that's where we want to get to. You know, we want to be number one choice, or we want to be the best in class, or something like that. Okay, do you have a vision in your company, Andrew? Do you have a vision? No, see? You don't have to have a vision, do you? You can be the best without the vision. But we have these visions. So here's a question. What's the vision that you have for your life? Where do you want to get to? You say, well, I want to get to heaven. Yeah, I know. But where do you want to be as a human being before you leave this world? So what was Jesus' vision for these men, and what's his vision for us? Well, in this chapter, you will see that there were three things that he wanted them. So in verse 5, he wanted them to bear fruit. And in verse 8, so that his Father would be glorified. Now, it's just worth clarifying here, because there are some commentators who take the view that bearing fruit is saving souls. But that's not what this means. Bearing fruit is these wonderful characteristics, the fruits of the Spirit. That is what he's talking about here, not winning souls. He wanted them to bear fruit, and the Father would be glorified. Secondly, verse 11, he wanted them that they would know joy. We talked about that this morning. That was the theme of this morning's sermon, about joy. So he wants them to bear fruit. He wants them to know deep joy. And verse 27, he wanted them to be his witness in the world. That was his vision for these men. So when he leaves them, he wants them to be there. So how did he go about it? How did he go about it? Well, he took them on this journey of 3 years. He shared his life with them. He developed their faith and reliance on him through the relationship with him. They saw him 24/7. They learned from him. This is not like one of those celebrities on the TV or the newsreader where you just see them, they've been made up. And you see them face on, and you don't see them first thing in the morning groggy or grumpy, do you? You don't see them on the train or in the car or getting angry with the traffic jams. You know, this is not like that. These disciples, they saw him 24/7. They lay next to him as he slept. They washed together. They walked and talked long distances. They saw him laugh and cry. There was humour, and there was sadness. Jesus opened his life and his heart to them. This was a rough, tough life. Working class men. He was gentle with them. And yet sometimes he was firm. We talked about friends, didn't we? That you can say anything to a friend and they can say anything to you. And a good friend will correct you at times. They will say, Mike, maybe you shouldn't do that. Maybe we don't like that very much sometimes. But a good friend will do that. Good friend will do that. So he did that. But he was gentle with them. Because sometimes they needed that firmness. He led by example. They listened to his speech, how he talked to people, how kind he was. He saw their acts of kindness. He saw the use of Jesus' time. You know, often we waste time, but they watched this man. You know, he had 3 years, and yet he took a lot of time with individuals. If he'd have been a modern evangelist, he'd have been ushered round in a limousine, wouldn't he? You say, you haven't got time to talk to a widow. A blind man, you haven't got time to them. That's going to take ages. You've got to go to the next big rally. There's 10,000 people waiting for you. But Jesus used his time to care for people, spend time with people. They watched his prayer life. You see, they watched him all the way through. But he also showed them that it wasn't smooth sailing. It was a tough life. And he watched them, and he showed them that there was hatred, there was turmoil, there were problems in life. He said, if the world hates you, know that it hated me. Remember, a servant is not greater than his master. And I think through those 3 years, Jesus was not only showing him what he was like as a model, as it were, but he also used the ups and downs, the failures, their failures, to build them up. You know, we don't grow as Christians in the good times. I think we grow as Christians in the difficult times. We develop strength when we're pushing. Muscles grow when you're exercising, and that's hard, isn't it? So think of the disciples in the boat. You know, that storm. You know, they were frightened. These were hard fishermen. They thought we're going to drown. And he's asleep. But then he wakes up, and they start to realize they can trust him. Peter was there on the water. He thought, it's great. I'm going to come to you, Lord, on the storm. I can walk on the water. But then he began to sink. Thought his life was in danger. Think of their denials and their shame. Jesus could have kept them from it all, but he didn't, because it was his plan to transform them from lost failures into triumphant saints. And it's the same for you and me. When we have Jesus as our friend, we walk with him, and he walks with us. And sometimes he takes us through the valley of the shadow of death. Sometimes he takes us through times which we would never choose. In fact, sometimes he takes us through times and we say to him, why are you doing this? If you were my friend, we may not say this out loud, but if we're honest, like the psalmist, we might say, if you were my friend, you wouldn't be doing this to me. Why would I be suffering like this? If you were my friend, you'd pull me out of this. You'd answer my prayer and make me better, or give me enough money to live, or whatever the thing might be. Why don't you do something about it? Jesus has chosen you to bear fruit. Jesus has chosen you, and he wants you to know joy, and he wants you to be a witness. And to do that, he has to sometimes take you through hard times, difficult times. He showed his disciples that the way to glory was via the cross. Their trials, their failures, the shame, the loss, the tears, the hardships, these are not a sign of his displeasure, but of a sign of his deep friendship and love for you. Which is hard to hear. Well, it's easy to hear, isn't it? But it's hard to trust and believe when times are hard. Easy to say when things are going well. Listen to this quote from one writer. Jesus was the truest of friends. He never tried to make the burden light, the path smooth, the struggle easy. He wished to make men of his apostles, men who could stand up and face the world, men whose character would reflect the beauty of holiness in every line, men in whose hands his gospel would be safe. He set for each apostle a high ideal and then helped him to work up to that ideal. He taught them that the law of the cross is the law of life, that the saving of one's life is the losing of it, and that only when we lose our life, as people rate it, giving out in love's service, do we really save it. And then there's this little poem that I found. Things that hurt and things that mar shape the man for perfect praise. Shock and strain and ruin are friendlier than smiling days. Before we leave this point, let's remind ourselves that Jesus enjoys our friendship as well. You think, you know, well, it's great that we have Jesus as our friend because he's able to help me. But did you know that Jesus enjoys your company? Isn't that astonishing? Think of these disciples. He valued their friendship. You know, we don't have an insight into what was said on the long journeys. We don't really have an insight into when they were sitting around, waiting for the sun to come up or the sun to go down. You know, there were lots of times and things we don't know. But he loved these men. He really loved them. And he wanted their support. Think of in the garden when he faced the cross. He was relying on them to watch and pray with him. They let him down. But he wanted that. He values your company. So when you pray, you go along and you say, well, I'm going to go and pray because there's loads of stuff I need. And Jesus is my friend. And I'm going to ask him for it because I'm sure he'll help me with this. But never forget that when you talk to Jesus, he enjoys your fellowship. He enjoys your company. It gives him pleasure. I mean, we often think of the father and the child, you know. And the child goes to the father because the child wants stuff. But think of the delight in the father or the mother with the child speaking to them. There's pleasure in that. So you bring pleasure to God, which is an astonishing thing, I think. So, let me ask you the question I ask myself. Let me ask you, what is your relationship with Jesus like? He reveals his heart to you and his desire through his word. This is how he reveals his word. We don't get it through visions and feelings. We get it through his word. So he has told you everything that's in his heart. He said to these disciples, the master, you know, the servant doesn't know what the master's doing because the master keeps it from the servants. But he said, I've told you everything. I've revealed my heart, my purpose, everything you need to know. I've shown you myself. You've seen everything about me. The question is, how much are we willing to show Jesus? How much are we willing to give him as our friends? How close do you want to get to this friend? Jesus said, abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. How close do you want to be to Jesus? There is no limit. There is no barrier. The only barrier is the one that we put up. Thirdly, Jesus chooses friends, Jesus transforms and ministers to his friends, and lastly, in this passage, Jesus dies for his friends, or died for his friends. In verse 13, we have this very well-known and well-used verse. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lays down his life for his friends. You are my friends. That word for, greater love has no one than this, that someone lays down his life for his friends. That's a very, very interesting word in the original. Now, I'm not a Greek scholar, but there are those who are. And what they tell us is that word carries with it the meanings for the benefit of, or even instead. So it would read, greater love has no one than this, that someone lays down his life for the benefits of his friends. Or, greater love has no one than this, that someone lays down his life instead of his friends. So this is what Jesus has done. Now, we use that verse sometimes when we think about soldiers dying in battle, don't we? You know, we think of the First World War, the Second World War, and we say that gave us... Well, there is a sense where that is true, isn't it? The soldier goes off to war, there's an invading army, let's talk, you know, maybe the Second World War, you've got the Germany and the Nazis, and they're coming across Europe, and the loved ones are at home, and the soldiers go, and they die, they give their lives, instead of the people who would be killed on invasion. So there is a sense where that is true. But here, it's completely different, isn't it? Because here, we know that Jesus gives his life, he wants us to be friends, but the only way he can have us as friends, the only way that he can spend eternity with his friends in glory, because that's the future, You know, heaven is not going to be a place where Jesus occasionally visits, drops in, a bit like sort of, you know, King Charles might drop in and just see how people on his estate are going now and again and doss his cap to them and they just sort of bow. It's not going to be like that. Jesus is going to be there with his friends. The other analogy, of course, is the bride and the bridegroom. These are pictures, wonderful pictures. And the only way that Jesus can spend eternity with his friends, who he's going to enjoy, is by dying in their place. And we know, don't we, that when Jesus hung on that cross, but his whole life was a sacrifice, but particularly on that cross, what happened? God was taking all the judgment for sin, for all the people who would ever be saved. The multitude that no man can number, multiplied by eternal desolation in hell, all of that was poured in, like a giant funnel, being poured into Christ, and Christ bore it all. No wonder he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And Christ took it all, and he paid the price, everything. It is finished. There's no more to pay. I've extinguished all the judgment of God. Everything has been paid now. And those who trust in me will be my friends, and they are completely forgiven. There is no sin that they can do that can make them sinners again. It's all been paid. If Jesus has paid the price for your sins, there is nothing you can do to tip the balance beyond what he has paid. You know? And Christians fall into sin all the time. Well, he did that for you. So what will you do for him in response? Will you give your life for this friend? You're not asked to give your life as he gave it for you. He asked you to put yourself on the altar as a living sacrifice. Somebody once said that the problem with a living sacrifice is it keeps crawling off the altar. That's true, isn't it? We say, Lord, I'm going to give myself to you. But then when that cross becomes a little bit too ugly, a little bit too heavy, we say, enough. But he did that for us. And he knows our frame. He knows we're weak. Jesus is your friend. He chose you in eternity past. God the Father gave you to his Son as a friend, as a bride. The Spirit came after you to find you, transform you, and you trusted Christ, and you thought you chose him. Oh, you may have thought that, but it was the other way around. He chose you with all your warts and all, as Cromwell said. When Cromwell was asked by his painter, how would you like me to paint you, Oliver Cromwell, he said, warts and all. Jesus chose you, warts and all. He's transforming you. And how are you going to be transformed? By walking close to him. Abide in me. Abide in me. And what does he want us to be? He wants us to be people who are joyful. He wants us to be people who bear much fruit. He wants us people who witness for him by our lives and our words. And never forget that he died for you to prove how much he loves you. There is nothing now that he won't do if he's done that.